Blog Talk Radio.
Transform 2 on Fast Forward Radio. The World Transform 2 is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find information about this series at speculist.com and worldtransformed.com. This series explores 10 major transformations that will forever change our world and our lives. Some of these transformations are likely to be upon us soon. Others are already underway. Throughout this series, we're talking with futurists, scientists, philosophers, artists, pundits, and other thinkers to gain a better understanding of what we need to do to prepare ourselves for these changes and for life in a world transformed. In the World Transformed 2, we're exploring how we think, life extension, nanotechnology, human enhancement, artificial general intelligence, virtual worlds, post-scarcity, existential risks, the technological singularity, and finally, human destiny. Tonight we present part 6 in the series, Reality Transformed. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well, very well. Just trying not to absolutely burn up down here in Louisiana. But, you know, I don't think I'm going to get much sympathy. It's hot everywhere.
Well, you know, it looks like there's just a major heat wave or heat waves occurring all across the country these days, but I know it's got to be pretty brutal down there in Louisiana with the humidity you guys get.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. It's definitely time to either be in a swimming pool or be in the air conditioning, one or the other. But it's got to cool off. So.
It's bad. Well, you know what? October will get here, and it'll cool off, if nothing else. So
you
got that to look forward to. So just a quick show note for those who are paying very close attention. We did play the Fast Forward Radio theme rather than the World Transformed theme at the beginning. We will play our World Transformed 2 theme music at the conclusion of the program tonight. Just checking to make sure everyone's paying attention. But we've got a terrific show lined up this evening, so I think we should jump right into it.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, there are some who seriously ask whether the universe we live in is the real universe or whether it's just a simulation of some kind, something like the virtual world depicted in The Matrix and sequels to that movie. And as we've talked about many times on Fast Forward Radio, Nick Bostrom's simulation hypothesis argues that one of the following three propositions is most likely true. One, that the human species is very likely to go extinct before reaching a post-human stage. Two, that any post-human civilization is extremely unlikely to run a significant number of simulations of their evolutionary history or any variations thereof. Or three, and this is the catch, this is the kicker here, three, that we're almost certainly living in a computer simulation. Now, that argument is far from being proof that we're living in a simulation. But for some of us, it's a pretty compelling argument anyway that we might be. And then meanwhile, we find that the world we're living in, whether it's the actual real world or not, increasingly is providing us with opportunities to experience simulations. And there's an expectation, I think probably a very correct expectation, that much more realistic and compelling and vivid simulations are right around the corner. And there are those of us who look forward to living in virtual worlds full time, and there are others who bemoan the loss of, quote, the real experience that's already occurring. So tonight we're going to explore all of those issues. We're going to look at the nature of the, quote, unquote, real world, and we've assembled a panel of experts to help us get a handle on these issues. So, Stephen, let's introduce them now.
Absolutely. Dr. Bruce Katz is a leading thinker and researcher in the field of artificial intelligence with more than 20 years of expertise in designing and developing self-learning systems based on artificial intelligence. He is the chief AI scientist at Coldlight Solutions and the author of Neuroengineering the Future, Virtual Minds and the Creation of Immortality. Dr. Katz received his Ph.D. in AI in 1990 from the University of Illinois. Between 1990 and 1998, he was a lecturer on AI at the University of Sussex in the UK and serves as an adjunct professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His articles have appeared in many prestigious journals, and he is the author of the book Digital Design, From Gates to Intelligent Machines. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us again, Bruce. I'd like to also introduce Natasha Vita Moore. She is Chair of Humanity Plus and a lecturer and the creative director of the H Plus Lab for Scientific and Artistic Design. Natasha is a fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and Ethics Track Advisor to the Singularity University. She's a PhD researcher at the Planetary Collegium, University of Plymouth. Her thesis concerns transformative human enhancement and life expansion, two hot topics here on The World Transformed. She holds a BFA from the University of Memphis. She's a filmmaker in residence at the University of Colorado and has a Master of Science from the University of Houston, a Master of Philosophy from the University of Plymouth. Natasha, great to have you with us as always.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It'll be fun visiting with you, Natasha. I'm looking forward to it. We also have with us Jim Elvidge. He holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He has applied his training in the high-tech world as a leader in technology and expertise management, including many years in executive roles for various companies and entrepreneurial ventures. He also holds 4 patents in digital signal processing. Beyond the high-tech realm, however, Elvidge has years of experience as a musician, writer, and truth seeker. He merged his technology skills with his love of music, developed one of the first PC-based digital music samplers, and co-founded Radio Amp, the first private label online streaming radio company. Jim has spent many years researching the fields of quantum mechanics, cosmology, ancient history, consciousness, anomalous occurrences, and future technologies. While there may certainly be greater experts in any one of these fields, it takes a combination of open-mindedness and deep knowledge in all these fields to see the whole picture. For this reason, he feels uniquely qualified to write such books such as The Universe Solved, and we certainly are glad to have you on the program tonight, Jim.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and it's great to be on again.
Well, welcome, panel. It's a real honor to have all three of you with us, and as we have done throughout The World Transformed 2, we're going to be looking at this transformation of our, we call it reality transformed. Perhaps that's what's happening, or perhaps it's our perception of reality, our understanding of reality, but with an eye to answering the following questions. We want to come to a better understanding of why we should be concerned about this transformation, what individuals ought to be doing about it, and what we as a society ought to be doing about it. So with that in mind, Stephen, you want to kick it off?
Well, absolutely. Let me just ask, I'll just throw this out kind of in general. I guess we might just want to start with a particular guest. Jim, let me just ask you, are virtual worlds are going to be important? I mean, are they, let me just ask you first, I suppose, do you expect to see, hyper-realistic virtual reality anytime soon, and what role are they going to play?
Yeah, I absolutely expect to see that. The time frame all kind of depends on the resolution that you might be talking about, but I like to talk about the point at which a simulation is indistinguishable from reality. So that point might be 20, 30 years out if you kind of extrapolate where we are today, take Moore's Law into account, take some other factors into account. I think that there's definitely an interest in this. If you go back to when we started creating movies, when we started even as far back as creating images on cave walls, we were thinking symbolically. We were, creating different realities. We were recording realities effectively. Movies to us are kind of an escape. And although it's on a flat screen, it's a little bit cumbersome in a way to kind of get embedded into that experience. We do things like 3D glasses and Disney World has things like 4D experiences with little, you know, water sprays that come out at you, and they've experimented before with smell-o-vision and you know, little squirts of olfactory, you know, triggering devices and things like that. So, yeah, we keep on trying to get more and more realistic, and I believe that between brain-computer interfaces, so the ability to actually interface with the sensory signals of our brain, which we have done. We've developed retinal implants that have as many as, I think, 1,500 diodes on them that allow blind people to see. So we've actually been able to interface with the brain and inject imagery directly into the brain without having to go through some filters like glasses or goggles of some sort. So these kinds of technologies are just kind of at their infancy, and they're going to increase in complexity and resolution, and before you know it, we will be executing simulations that are virtually indistinguishable from reality, and I think that's going to happen 20, 30 years out from now.
Okay. Bruce, same question. Let me just ask, are virtual worlds that are, you know, realistic enough to the point that you can't distinguish them from the world we're living in, is that a coming thing, and will it be important?
Yeah, I'm slightly more skeptical than Jen. I believe it will happen. I just think it's going to take a bit longer. I'm looking at my desk right now, and I have an old bowl of ice cream that was sort of half eaten, and I didn't have chance to get rid of, and the pattern inside this bowl, which is actually, it's a little disgusting, but it's also because it's been sitting here for a day, but it's visually just an amazing pattern, and extremely high resolution, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult to achieve the amount of information, even in a small scale, even in what I'm looking at now, my desk or my room, or certainly on a larger scale, it's the street on which I live, within the next 30 years. I think it's going to take much longer. On a more positive note, more optimistic note, and this also echoes something that Jen was saying, we don't have to necessarily do everything. And we have some good precedents for that. And when I say we don't have to do everything, I mean we don't have to do all the simulations on the digital side. The brain has the capacity to fill in some of the gaps, and we already know that because we have a blind spot. Right in the center of our retina, and yet somehow we don't see when our conscious vision of the world does not include that blind spot. And the reason is that we're able to fill in a rather complex way, even patterns. We're able to fill in what's missing there. So I think some combination of certainly increased resolution on the visual side, plus increased understanding of the brain, will take us there. Probably not in 20 years, but I would say closer to 50.
That's a really interesting point that you make, Bruce. Because it seems that most people have not a physical, but just a psychological, or maybe just an attention based blind spot to most detail most of the time, right? So when you look around the room, you find the melted bowl of ice cream, and suddenly you're seeing at a much higher level of resolution than you would have before, and I don't know, maybe you do sit around and notice things like that to that level of detail all the time. But it seems that there would be a question when they were rolling out these kinds of systems around how much do people really need, how much do they really want, how much do they expect in order for it to be a compelling experience.
Hey Phil, can I just offer one thing real quick? I agree with Bruce. There's a lot of variables here in terms of trying to determine when this might happen. Some of the data that I used were things like, Moore's law varies depending on what you're talking about. If you talk about transistor density, it's kind of 2 years when technology doubles. If it's processor speed, it's more like 2.8. Screen resolution is a little bit higher. So if you look at kind of screen resolutions and realize that given the limitations of our perceptual resolution, if we can get to the point of 150 megabytes representing an image, that's about 16 years away if we continue to follow Moore's law as it is. And there are certainly possibilities that it may flatten out or something like that, which would extend that a little bit further. So that's where I came up with some of that data. And then, you know, other avenues for generating these kind of simulations, which might have to do with brain-computer interfaces, those may take a little bit longer. So I agree.
Well, Natasha, I want to definitely get you in on this discussion. What's your thoughts? Do we have super hyper-realistic virtual reality in a few years, and what role does that play in the world?
Well, first, I think we need to take a look at what is reality and unpack it. I mean, going back to Plato, to Nietzsche, to Baudrillard, to Deleuze, you know, there's a number of different concepts about simulacra and different artificial systems and what is real, and you break that down and we get into the environment. The environment is reality, and if we look at it that way, then we have an argument versus radical constructivism versus scientific realism. And on the other side of the coin, we take a look at who are we in reality, and that gets into the issue of existence. And you break that down and it becomes the issue. More than the environment, it is who do we want to become? Who are we within this environment that we're talking about being simulated or artificial? So the environment means less to me than who we are in becoming part of it. Why are we creating it? Because we want to be in these different types of simulated artificial environments, whether it's full immersivity, virtuality, synthetic upload state, whole brain emulation state, or just to transverse across different types of metaverses and more pixelated, fine-tuned environments. The issue here goes beyond the technology and beyond the environment itself. It's about the personal existence, the personal identity within that. If we are to have full immersivity in virtuality, which I think is right around the corner, we have to identify what aspects of ourselves and our perceptions we want to be in it. And that brings us to the perceptual phenomenological aspect of reality in our existence. We can create the environment in virtuality to be very much like a Second Life or a film where we're observers, or we can be more like an order cybernetics where we're the observers within the system that we're observing and we're creating it. To me, it's just common sense that it's happening. We're already partly there. I don't like making predictions, and I think it's almost it's a cop-out almost to say it's going to happen by a certain date because no one knows. In fact, no one knows what reality is, and no one knows what consciousness is. The beauty with that is that we can play with it and enjoy it and design it and be the steers people of this type of future where we're splitting ourselves, our identities, into multiple aspects of ourselves and playing and enjoying and exploring and inventing along the way. So to answer your question in brief, yes, I think it's going to happen. I think it'll happen sooner than later. Will it be perfect to start out with? Absolutely not. Will we make it better as we go along? Absolutely. Will there be one type of simulated environment? No, there'll be multiple types of environments. We base the computational system on what we have today. We know computers and we know codes, so that's how we look at it. Not looking at it from a chemical point of view in chemistry, so we don't know what type of environment or simulation we would create in a chemical composition. So what we know now is computation, and what we know now is that virtuality is a very tasty option.
Interesting stuff. You know, I love the idea that we don't know what reality is. I can't define it. We don't know what consciousness is. But let me try to. Let me see if we can nail down one term that is a little less ambitious, and let's talk about what it means to be virtual. When is an experience a virtual experience? And I want to use one of my favorite little anecdotes from the history of the city of San Francisco. Some of you may know this fellow by name. In 1859, a guy named Joshua Norton declared himself to be Norton the First, the Emperor of the United States. And he was fortunate, actually, that he was living in San Francisco at the time, because that was a city where a certain amount of eccentricity at that time and even today would be tolerated and I think even encouraged. And so for years, this guy lived a fairly regal life. He got free meals in certain restaurants. There were fine clothes that were made for him. He was once accidentally arrested. The chief of police wrote this profuse apology, and he ended up granting an imperial pardon to the officer who arrested him. And from that day on, the police officers in San Francisco always saluted him when they saw him. And so in a certain sense, this man had the subjective experience of being an emperor, of being the emperor of the United States. Now, my question is, was Norton living in a virtual world? If we suffer from delusions, or if we're just confused about what's happening to us, or when we dream, are we living in a virtual world? We'll start that one with you, Natasha. We'll stay with you.
Well, I think that's a slippery slope and a red herring. For one thing, I think that the man may have suffered from delusion. Best case scenario, he had personality dissociative disorder, dissociation disorder. I'm not quite sure what the medical term is for it. Another thing, he was a fraud and ripping people off, and I don't respect that. So was he living in a virtual world? Yes, as far as psychology is concerned, that would be a type of virtual world. As far as the issue that we're discussing tonight, where we're speaking specifically and rigorously about the possibility of engaging virtuality as a reality transformed, I would say that's red herring, not interested.
Okay. See if anyone else wants to bite on this. When the mind tells us something is real, Bruce, is that a virtual experience? Is that in some sense related to what we're talking about, or is it, as Natasha says, a red herring?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Natasha here. I think it is a kind of slippery herring, or what did she say? Red herring? Red herring is
red herring. Or a slippery slope. Either way.
A slippery slope.
A red slope, a slippery herring. They all
red slope.
Going the wrong direction.
Yeah, small turning, whatever. But I think it's nothing like what a sane person would be experiencing in a modern digital virtual reality. However, it does bring up an interesting point tangentially, which is, do we want to create worlds in which we are pleased too often? Which apparently, you know, this gentleman's mind was capable of doing. Or do we want to create worlds in which we have constraints? So the idea is that it's only through constraints that we learn. So we walk into our virtual world, and there's lots of beautiful women or beautiful men or whatever your preference is. And do we get them right away? No, not like this guy did. We're going to impose constraints upon ourselves in order to make it more difficult, in order to ultimately enjoy the experience more. So it brings up that issue, but I agree.
You're anticipating a subsequent question that we'll get to eventually. Emperor Norton is introduced here to provide a springboard for that. That later question. What do you think, Jim? Was Emperor Norton living in a virtual world?
I'll tell you. I'm not afraid to slip on red herring. So I'll go for it here. I think that one of the things that we have to be a little careful of is the lexicon that we use. We don't really have a well-established lexicon around ideas of alternative realities and simulations. People talk about simulations, and it's actually a very hard thing to define, and it's a very hard thing to define what is real. If we discovered at some point that what we think is real today, and you know, we wake up to that and there's another reality, does that mean that we were in a virtual one or we were in a simulation? How do we know that the new one is any more real than the other one? I kind of subscribe to the consciousness-centric view of the universe, that we create our reality, and you know, quantum mechanics bears that out in many ways. But if that's the case, then all Emperor Norton was doing was creating his own reality. Unfortunate if he ripped anybody off, but we all have different subjective experiences. We could sit in a lecture and have a completely different experience than the person sitting next to us. So it's really hard to you know, comment on whether one person's reality is virtual or real or anything like that. And one final thing about disorders, personality disorders, sometimes to me are evidence of something that may happen to the brain that actually is special in a way. It's not necessarily that these people are, you know, have negative brain function. Perhaps a filter has been turned on that allows them to have more enhanced brain function, as some autistic people have been shown to have. Schizophrenics experience different realities. You know, who is to say that the reality that they're experiencing might not be a more real reality that we don't experience because the rest of us have that filter in our brain that prevents us from hearing
That's
voices
a good point,
or whatever
unless you
else.
Have someone that you love who has suffered from schizophrenia, then I would hasten to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about mental illnesses and different types of mental diseases as being different types of virtual psychologies, to be sure, but I can't wrap it in a bow because it's a horrible thing to experience.
No, I'm definitely not saying that either. I'm just saying that, you know, the experience that they're having, while it may be difficult for their loved ones or it may be difficult for them even, it might be indicative of something that's not necessarily negative going on in their brain.
No, definitely I wouldn't say that it's a negative thing going on in their brain because each behavior, each life form is to be respected, and we're judging what is right and what is wrong based on a human-centric, dominated voice on what is normal and what is natural. And speaking of that, I think one of the biggest issues dealing with virtual worlds and simulations, which ties into Norton's issue, is the emphasis on normalcy and how we've determined over the eons in different cultures and different time frames what is normal, what is normalcy, and what is right and wrong based on a codified, predetermined notion of normal and normalcy. And I think that the virtual world of Second Life, for example, is having a heck of a time diffusing that with all sorts of behaviors, some pleasant, some not so pleasant. But it's certainly an arena where one can be schizophrenic to whatever degree or take on different psychological alternatives as a type of play, a type of ludics, if you will. It's an interesting study.
You know, you don't have to go as far as things that you know everybody agrees is mental illness for one set of people to think of another set of people as delusional. I mean, all you have to do is look at political parties. You know, you know, I mean, the Republicans,
or religious.
Think Democrats
yes.
are delusional, and vice versa. I mean, it's just I guess when it comes down to the reality, the subjective reality we experience, it maybe the best way to weigh it is. How successfully do we interact and in a positive way with others that are around us? They may not be experiencing the same, you know, subjective experience that we are, but if we're able to interact with one another in a way that's productive, you know, that's maybe that's the best way to measure it. And so, I guess pushing that forward into the virtual reality realms, I mean, how do we, how are we going to interact with one another in, you know, Second Life version 5.0 that's productive? How do we, do y'all have any thoughts of how this is something more than just a game?
Well, I don't know about anybody else, but there was a book written by Neal Stephenson called Snow Crash. It was a early cyberpunk thriller, kind of preceding the web, if I remember right. But it was kind of a blueprint for the idea of having double worlds, having a reality that you live in and then goggling into a virtual reality that you live in. Interestingly enough, the things that he proposed in that book, things like buying virtual real estate sounded outlandish at the time, but it's exactly what's going on right now. It's certainly not going on at the resolution of what we talk about being a, you know, a reality indistinguishable from our normal reality. But, you know, we do have in Second Life currencies and, you know, purchase of, you know, a virtual property. There's stock markets, all these kinds of things. Does it have a value? I'm not sure. I mean, I think it probably does. You know, maybe it allows people to socialize better. Maybe it allows people to, be creative. I mean, I could think of some different reasons why you might say that this has some value. I know IBM has conducted product announcements in virtual space, and other companies have done the same thing. So they've used it kind of as a tool. So, you know, I think that it really depends on how you use it.
Bruce, what do you think? Can virtual reality be used in ways that are productive, maybe even back in this reality?
I mean, there's no doubt it can be. I mean, if you conceive of life, I mean, it's not really this, but it's a series of lessons. So we have relationship, and then we break up. Then we have another relationship, 23. I'm not speaking personally here, but and that doesn't work out for various reasons. And then suddenly at 27, or 28, 32, whatever, we end up meeting the love of our life, in many cases, some cases at least. And in some ways, the previous relationships were preparation for that future relationship. And if those previous relationships, horrible as they may have been, did not work out, then the future relationship that did work out would not have occurred. And in fact, you don't have to apply this just to love relationships. Everybody we meet and everybody that we interact with, to a large extent, our interaction is a function of how we interacted with people in the past. So my point is this. Can we be put in a virtual system such that we learn these lessons faster? So we have a relative, as I don't have to tell everybody who's listening or on the line now, we have a relatively short span of time on this earth. And that means that we only have X number of significant lessons that we can learn. Can that be accelerated? Can we be put into a pressure cooker of life's lessons, so to speak, to accelerate that process even before we reach some sort of singularity where we're able to achieve some immortality or quasi-immortality? And I think that's possible. I think we do that already. Certainly sports is one big area. Just trying to perfect your tennis swing or your golf swing, and especially if you're playing a sport that interacts with an opponent, that is sort of like a mini pressure cooker of lessonhood. But could we accelerate that? Yes, definitely. It's not just a question of going online as we're doing now, learning calculus or learning quantum mechanics. It's going online and experiencing important things that are important for us, for our identities, and important for us emotionally.
Now, Bruce, as you were speaking, something else just popped into my mind. I could imagine being immersed in an environment in, say, Italy or France, if you want to learn Italian or French or a different language. It's probably a much more effective way to learn than reading a book or listening to tapes.
Most definitely. Not only being immersed in the language, but being immersed in the culture. Speaking of reality, we do have a limited, I agree. I mean, we don't want to have a schizoid view of reality, but on the other hand, we do have a limited view of reality. And our reality, my reality to some extent, I've lived in many different countries, so it's a little bit more broad than the typical American, but my reality is basically that of an American East Coast person of, late 20th century. And that's not the only way of looking at things. And, I would love to, interact with Don Juan's, Carlos Castaneda's Don Juan and people like that more directly rather than just through a book.
Natasha, Jim gave a really good example of, learning Italian by immersing himself in the culture virtually. You got any other ideas how virtual worlds that we could take experiences there and bring them back in and be productive in the real world?
Yeah, I was listening to him and then thinking, and it all came together when he mentioned Carlos Castaneda, and Carlos Castaneda made up his stories. He never had the experiences that he wrote about with the medicine man, and he was a bit of a trickster. And in his trickster behavior in writing his fiction, claiming it to be fact, he created a delusion for people. And during that time frame, he became a hero, a mystical hero for many people who believed what he wrote. And I don't believe he was being mean about it. I think he was, you know, just doing what he felt he needed to do. But he created a reality that was a simulated reality, an artificial reality based on information he fed to people as fact. And I think that's very interesting to consider, that how we perceive information oftentimes makes up this perceptual gap that we have. And that brings me around to the issue about perceptual experiences. And when we talk about simulated environments, especially in transformative reality, I mentioned earlier, what is it we want to transform? And if we want to transform ourselves to be more conscientious, to be more empathic, to be more intelligent, more creative, more thought-provoking beings, then it makes sense that we create problems within a virtual environment for us to solve, because we as humans love problem solving. And that would be one way of role-playing and game-playing that we would engage in. But the more important thing here, or maybe not more important, but that is affected by, and it affects the ourselves when we enhance to have different type of perceptual experiences that we have in this reality. Our five or so many senses allow us a perceptual reality that we call the real world, the real reality, and we exist within it. If and when we enhance our senses and have different types of senses, whether it's in real time this time or in a virtual artificial environment, those senses will be different than we perceive now. So the whole paradigm shift is more about our perceptions of reality rather than the reality being transformed. I hope I'm making that clear, that the reality is not going to transform any faster than human enhancement, because the technologies we're talking about are your basic NEMBIC, nano-bio-info, cogno, and then you add on to that robotics and artificial general intelligence. And then you integrate that with the human physical corporeal body, and you also incorporate that within the virtual, synthetic, artificial, disembodied, distributed selves, which really I don't agree with Catherine Hales on that. We'll always have some kind of body or envelope within which our consciousness exists. So we're looking at perceptions being so different than we can perceive them now. So the exciting aspect of this session that you've created for us is that we're trying to perceive it with the parameters of our perceptual abilities, and it would be a great leap for us to try to imagine what it would be like with different perceptual abilities.
That is the trick, isn't it? And it seems that we're forced to rely on analogies that we know can only take us so far. I think it's really interesting when we talk about what Castaneda was doing. Because, Natasha, as I'm listening to you talk about that, I'm saying, yes, yeah, that's what he did. But in a sense, that's kind of what everybody does when they write fiction, right? I mean, there's always an aspect of creating a...
He was saying he was writing fact.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, that's the real difference when you say you're writing something true,
yes, right,
and it's fiction. But so he kind of broke the rules, right?
Yes.
There's this other set of rules around fiction. Yeah, he was a bad boy. But there's this other set of rules around fiction, which says I'm creating this made up place, and we're all going to we're going to suspend our disbelief and share the idea that this is real. So we have these early analogs to what we'll be experiencing later. But it's as with so many of the topics we talk about in The World Transformed, it's pretty hard to get your head around where we are now. Where we're going to be, even in a historically speaking, short period of time. So I'm going to take this same question that that Stephen asked, and I'm gonna rip off it just a little bit, because Stephen's talking about the advantages that we can get in the real world from virtual worlds. Let me ask this: assuming that it's not those advantages that we can get in the real world, what is the greatest benefit or the greatest set of benefits that we stand to gain from this migration to virtual worlds, or this including of them into our world? And the flip side of that is the two-part question would be, what is the greatest risk or the greatest set of risks that making that same move would pose? Bruce, let's start with you on that one.
Yeah, well, there's a tremendous risk, but we'll get to that shortly. I would just continue along the same lines as I was previously speaking about. So rather than think about a set of experiences that we can get from the virtual world, which sort of makes virtual reality like just an enhanced digital world, which is not very interesting, I would prefer to think about it as different modes of experience. And certainly one of the chief ways of getting out away from our fixed mode that we happen to be in is by experiencing other cultures. So in other words, if you look at Chinese culture or a culture that I'm very familiar with, Turkish culture, rather than just thinking about it as a set of disjoint items, here's the language, here's the music, here's the art, here's the literature, here's the food, there's an intimate connection between everything within that culture. And that connection, for example, certain types of food are eaten by certain types of people. And if you experience it in sufficient detail, you realize that there's actually a connection between the food and the music, even when you're not listening to the music while you're eating the food at the same time. And it becomes sort of a mode of being. So if virtual realities can transport us to these other modes, that will ennoble us and enable us to grow in a much faster fashion than if we're simply experiencing something flashy that we couldn't experience, let's say, just by watching a very high-resolution plasma screen. Okay, so I think that's the chief advantage. The chief advantage is going beyond ourselves, and this also relates to Natasha's original point of having to do with identity. Expanding our identity and allowing that identity to at least incorporate other modes of being. That also brings up the greatest danger. What if your identity changes too quickly? And the answer to that, we already know. We don't have to, we don't have to do any experiments. We don't have to speculate or talk about the future. We know what happens when identity changes too quickly. That's called losing your mind. It also brings up the schizoid and the other things that we were also talking about. So that the chief danger, we want to expand, we want to grow, but we don't want to be like a balloon that expands too quickly and incorporates too many different experiences, because then we won't have any core of our identity. So I think that's the greatest danger. And it's probably not a danger that we realize right now, because our experiences are so limited. We see the same sorts of people, they tend to act in the same sorts of way. If you want to make it a little bit more concrete, just think of it as a culture shock, but on a much larger scale, and being really immersed in a different culture, but not just being immersed, your brain is changing, everything is different, and it's happening very quickly. And then if that happens with enough cultures or too fast with a given culture, then you're going to go insane.
That's really interesting. We're talking with Ben Goertzel last week, and the subject was actually artificial intelligence, but he touched on the same idea of growing too quickly and the direction he took it. And let me test and see if this is in line with what you're saying. He didn't talk about necessarily losing your mind, but the other risk, the one that he mentioned, is just losing yourself. That you just wouldn't be that you would change so dramatically and rapidly that it would not be the kind of continuous experience of being yourself, and that you just wouldn't be you anymore. Do you think that's a risk as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a different thing than losing self and losing your mind. I think losing your mind is just one way of expressing the fact that the fundamental character of all mental illness is a weak identity, and that's the one connecting connector between all sorts of depressive, manic depressive, and also schizoid behaviors. There's not enough core there, and you know we don't have to be Freudians to realize why that is. I mean, often it's simply because the mother figure and the father figure did not fuse within that particular mind.
I had a brother who was schizophrenic. My mother and father were very. My brother had a very strong identity. He was mentally ill, though. He was schizophrenic, but he had a very strong identity. He knew who he is.
Well, knowing who you are does not mean you have a strong identity.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I don't understand what you're talking.
I mean, there's a separate argument here, and whether that's the case. But I mean, the other point is that the original point was that growing too quickly, especially growing into other modes, will cause you delusional.
I think
as a loss of identity, a loss of self, or going outside your mind, you know, that's largely a semantic issue.
Yeah, I think let me stay with this just for a minute, because I think the distinction might be what Ben was talking about was what comes out on the other side might be a perfectly whole and integrated and healthy person, right? It's just not you anymore, right? It's just it happens so quickly that the kernel didn't come along for the ride, as opposed to losing your mind, which seems to imply that that what's coming out the other side of that transformation is less healthy, less balanced, less stable, less ready to deal with whatever the challenges are going to be next. Okay, so Natasha, let's take the same question over to you. Greatest potential benefits, greatest potential risks of virtual worlds.
I'll start with the risks, if I may, please. I think, gosh, I'd say there's three that I can think of right off the top. First is an obvious dependence on our biology. We would lose that. We would lose our relationship with death, as it's been experienced and understood for eons. And we'd lose an historical psychology associated with being a biological animal. That's pretty serious stuff. I mean, humans, our species has been an animal for quite some time. And to make that paradigm shift where we are no longer sequestered and tethered to our biology, unleashing that, just that in and of itself is phenomenal. Along with that, not having to die, a different psychology, different perceptual abilities. So we become basically a subspecies of human. What would we benefit from? I suppose what we'd benefit from that more than anything would be a new challenge. And when we take a look around at the behaviors of humans today, it's oftentimes embarrassing when we look at the number of people who have depression or have certain diseases, including obesity and depression. It's shocking and frightening and tremendously sad and devastating. How many happy people are there? I'm not talking about happiness as far as a utilitarian perspective. I'm talking about just enjoying life. It's the joie de vivre is not something that's commonplace, as obviously presented with our media. But in the answer that I wrote to you, I think the most important thing for us to be aware of goes to what Ben talked about and what I've talked about so often, is that element of continuity of personal identity and our consciousness. And we would just become different people. And I think that could be a possible blessing in disguise.
Well, certainly there's a process of becoming a different person that is viewed as a perfectly positive thing, right? We change over time, and sometimes we manage to change for the better. but it's that issue of continuity that seems to
And that's what personal identity is. I mean, we have agency, we know that. We have personhood, we know that, but it's the issue of personal identity, the continuation of self over time, and especially something everyone spoke of, I think, is the multiple selves and multiple environments, that type of snow crash idea, and the idea also in William's book about Aristoi, where you have multiple selves, multiple personas and multiple environments, multiple realities, keeping them, the continuity between them, I think would be a really big architectural field. The architect of cells probably become a very big field when all this comes around.
Absolutely. Okay, Jim, same question over to you now. What do you think? Big benefits, big risks related to virtual worlds?
Yeah, sure. And I just wanted to just make one comment on something Natasha said. I hope we can come back to it, about the idea that we are permanently tethered to our bodies. I'm not 100% convinced of that, actually by a long shot. So I hope that's something that we can come back to later on. Interestingly,
we're talking about it now. You can address it right now if you'd like to. Actually.
Okay, but I'll go back to your question first. Interestingly,
okay.
I read an article recently called "Are You the Same Person You Were Yesterday?" And the idea was that our cells continually die and they continually get replenished. And the average age of a brain cell, if I remember right, was 10 years. And yet we have this continuity of identity, which I think is kind of interesting. That said, in terms of the set of benefits, I think some of the things that Bruce talked about, you know, the ability to learn in a more realistic setting might enhance your learning capabilities, would be good. I think of, you know, what kinds of things might virtual worlds give a benefit to in terms of us advancing our humanity, advancing our responsibility or our values. And, you know, as a specific example, the Japanese fishermen that club dolphins to death, what if they were able to experience what it's like to be a dolphin? Maybe that would change their behavior. In some ways, I'm not a big fan of humanity based on the way we behave. And I think, you know, anything that gives us a vehicle toward advancing our values is probably a good thing. Expansion of consciousness might be another, positive aspect out of virtual world experiences. On the negative side, certainly militarization. We seem to be able to militarize anything. Cyber wars are an example of militarizing the online space, and I imagine that we could probably do something similar in the virtual world. And just lack of socialization that might result from being too much in a fantasy or being too much in something that's detached from reality. I mean, we see it as people walk down the street staring at their cell phones and practically collide with each other or, you know, drive off the road. That lack of socialization is increasing in our society, and I don't think it's always a good thing.
And there's that famous YouTube video of lady looking at her cell phone walking through the mall and falling right in that fountain.
Oh yeah,
that kind of went viral for a while.
I think she actually sued the mall for that release of that video.
Oh, it's good for having the fountain there in the first place, right? Go ahead, Jim. You had some thoughts on how tethered we are to our body. I'd like to explore that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know about the other guests, I suspect that they may believe that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain, and I kind of think there's a lot of evidence that it's not necessarily. Just as an example, John von Neumann, the founder of, or the father of modern-day computing, estimated many years ago that we experience 280 trillion bits of data in our lifetime. I suspect that it's much higher, and some of the things that I've read indicate that that's probably an understatement, and yet we have 100 billion neurons, so it's off by a factor of 3,000, assuming that you can recall all of those experiences, and through hypnosis, the evidence seems to be that you can pretty much recall anything that you have experienced in the past. So that sort of implies maybe an external data store that Irvin Laszlo calls the Akashic Field. Maybe the communication mechanism with that data store is quantum entanglement or something like that. But, you know, that's something that's not well explained. from a logic field, you know, there's an argument that, you know, and I think there's a neuroscientist at UCLA, I forget his name at the moment, but he documented cases of kind of top-down causation where the mind makes chemical changes, the mind causes chemical changes in the brain. So there's, you know, there's evidence of free will, and probably the biggest one is Pim von Lommel's work on near-death experiences, where I think there was one case where a woman was turned upside down, the blood drained from her brain in order to perform a delicate experiment, so there was no oxygen circulating through her brain, there was, you know, no electrical function at all, and yet she was able to recall the experience in detail. There's tremendous evidence of this, which indicates that there is something in addition to the, you know, the tethering of our consciousness to our body.
Okay, let me rebut. I said we would, I can't remember what I said, something about that the untethering, unleashing ourselves, our identity, our consciousness from our biological body. Biology is chemical in part, but I was talking about biology as far as materiality of biology, the physical material body. When I think of quantum physics, I think more in terms of chemistry. And when I think of the phenomenological aspect of maybe Matriana or Varela, when I'm thinking about autopoiesis and when it gets into, you know, different areas of consciousness and whatnot, I think more in terms of chemistry, perhaps, or some type of electromagnetic field of certain energy particles. That's a different matter. When I say untethering to the biological body, what I mean is untethering to the particulars of the biological body, meaning being born and dying, and the time in between, which is, certainly according to Hayflick's theory, a specific time frame within which, on a linear basis, that can exist. So that's to clarify, that's the package that I'm talking about. So I don't think you are disagreeing with me. I think that perhaps I didn't explain it carefully enough.
No, I think you're right, and it was perhaps my eagerness to get into that topic, because I think that's part of what we kind of set up at the beginning was the idea of, you know, are we, you know, living in a simulation now, and we haven't
right.
quite gotten there.
Right. Yeah, good point.
I promise we will get there before the program is over. But before we do, Bruce, do you want in on this at all? Any response on the thoughts of the tethering of the of consciousness or of subjective experience to the body?
I have one relatively minor point. The fact that when we're hypnotized, we remember a particular experience in great detail. Does not imply that we remember all our experiences in great detail. So we're hypnotized, and then we remember that our first kiss that we had in eighth grade in great detail, but that's because that was a very salient experience. Then what happened, let's say, the day before, we have no memory whatsoever. So there's just a minor point about that hypnosis argument. I think a more important point has to do with the distinction between whether we are currently untethered or tethered loosely to the body, in the Cartesian sense, that there's a soul sort of floating above in the ether that's tethered to our brain. And so we have to make a distinction between that kind of untethering and the possibility of unbinding the mind from the body. Now, the second possibility, which I just mentioned, is a weaker claim and much more likely than the first possibility. In other words, even if it is not the case that we have both a distinct non-material soul and a material brain and a material body, even if it's not the case that those two things are actually distinct, it's still a strong possibility that we can insert ourselves into a virtual world or even into an automaton or a robot or something else and leave our birth body behind. And I think almost everybody agrees that in some way or other that's going to be a possibility, number one. And number two, that is going to be the surest way of achieving immortality, not by taking the right sort of vitamins and re-engineering the brain in just the right sort of way such that this decrepit husk, I'm speaking in my own case, I don't want to apply it to any of you guys, not so this thing survives 110, 150, 200 years. Really what's going to happen and the surest way of achieving immortality is going to be untethering the mind by digitally uploading it to another medium.
I think that's right. And to me, it's really interesting that I can completely put aside the question of whether consciousness is an emergent phenomenon of the brain or whether it's something else that's a quantum phenomenon or it's something that is just undefinable. From the fact that currently we seem to be very much tied to the architecture of the entire body in our thinking processes. I'm going through this experience right now. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and we're shopping preschools, right? And one of the discussions you get into is the program, the academic program or the learning program, is it play based or is it academic based? Interesting discussion you have about whether you're sitting down and dealing with knowledge in the abstract with kids, or whether they're learning through this process that involves auditory information, all the senses. So there's this kinesthetic aspect. There's this we're moving and learning, we're hearing and learning, we're touching and learning, and the preponderance of the scientific data seems to show that up to a certain developmental level, we learn a lot faster, we learn a lot better following that kind of methodology. Now, there's a point where it does kick in, and you can deal with information in the abstract. But it seems that for the time being, and certainly in our earlier developmental stages, we're very much tied to the body. In terms of how we process and deal with information, how we make the best use of it, and I think that there will be artifacts of that for a long time to come, even as we start making some of those transitions.
Phil, I'd like to ask about a particular risk and see what the panel thinks. Imagine a future where half of us have disappeared into one virtual reality or another, and the rest of humanity has not. And I mean, does that represent like a fracturing of our civilization? Is that sort of thing inevitable, or what are we looking at as far as that risk goes? I guess I'll throw that. Let me start with you, Jim.
I don't know that I'd say inevitable. Again, it's hard to predict the future and which way things would go. I could see, the kind of technologies that we're talking about creating the possibility of people who can afford it or people who can't, and maybe having some kind of divergence there. But those divergences tend to even out after a while as technology comes down in price. So I'm not sure that's. I don't know. I'm not sure that one would be something to be concerned about.
Okay. Natasha?
I was just thinking about the canary in the cave. Maybe it's not such a good idea to be the richest person and the most famous, who wants to go first. Maybe, the tables could turn. Maybe it's not such a, you think about, although I get this all the time, and I've been working in this field for 30 years, and it never stops about, overpopulation, it's a selfish thing to do, the elite, will only be the ones, the haves and the have-nots, and guaranteed and warranted and understood, these are very important questions, and they're socio-political questions, and I understand them. And you know, it takes a lot of patience to have to keep on answering them over and over. But, you know, it's interesting. It's just like it's interesting to me that where once I was opposed to Descartes, now I'm going, well, maybe we will separate the brain, the consciousness from the body. Maybe it's not in the brain if we are uploads. You know, it kind of turns the table around on that whole issue of us transhumanists who have been strong proponents of the idea of consciousness being located within the mind, which is what the brain does. But when we take a look at whole brain emulation, well, certainly isn't that, you know, Cartesian? So when we, you know, the tables turn on a lot of our earlier notions of the way things are supposed to be, or the fears that we have, and this fear that the haves and the have-nots and only the elite will be able to be the ones that, you know, go on into the next subspecies of our Homo sapiens sapiens, it may not be like that at all, you know. So warranted, the greatest issue for me is one of which I wrote in the response to you all and what I consider to be the risk that we need to, or the issue that we need to face, the problem is psyche risk, not existential risk, which I think is a wrong phrase to use. It ought to be called extinction risk, because that's what it is. It has nothing to do with existentialism and Sartre, et cetera. It's extinction risk. And within then, with its extinction risk, the issue of our psyche risk, our life risk, our personal identity risk, those are the real risks that I think that are important to us consider, and it engages everyone. We all have personal identity. We all are persons. We all are alive. And so it's we're all in this together. That's my two cents, boys. That's all I have to say on that. I don't know anything else. I'm sorry.
Well, Bruce, what do you think? Is will civilization fracture? Half of us going virtual and half of us remaining?
I'm not terribly bothered by egalitarian concerns at this point. Maybe I should be, but nature of my personality. I mean, there's no doubt that this person to achieve uploading of the mind or virtual immortality is going to spend a tremendous amount of money. I mean, I estimated could probably do it within 20 years for about $100 billion. And by the way, if there's anybody out there who has that kind of money, I can certainly help you with your venture. But the first person to do this, it's going to take a tremendous effort, equal or greater than magnitude to the efforts of reaching the moon, and it's going to be a similar sort of cost. And it's only going to provide immortality for that one person, that one guy or that one woman, probably a internet billionaire, who's able to afford this. But then it's going to gradually trickle down, and eventually it will reach all of us. The bigger concern, Natasha mentioned, is how that's going to interact with our personal growth. And the other thing is just as importantly, when will it come, and when will it be possible to do this with a reasonable amount of money? So let's say $1 million. When will it be possible for just you can only scrounge together $1 million if you actually need to, if that's going to make you immortal. When is that going to come in any of our lifetimes? So that's a personal concern of mine, and I think it's a good question that a lot of other people are asking.
What do you think, Phil? Weigh in on this one, Phil. Do you think civilization is in trouble? We're going to have everybody checking out?
I don't think it's in trouble. I think the others have the panel has well answered the issue of whether it goes to justice or whether there's an egalitarian aspect to it. But there is a concern, I guess, that humanity becomes essentially two different species. Although we should keep in mind that for most of the history of the larger humanity, of which we're, you know, Homo sapiens, as Natasha pointed out, is just a smaller part. There usually were a couple of species going at the same time, you know.
I was just thinking about that. Didn't we just find out that we've been mating with the Neanderthal?
Yeah, Neanderthals were here at the same time, and Homo erectus, they were there for a long time with
exactly.
a lot of other species coming and going. And so it's really more a concern of how well will the two get along? Do they become completely irrelevant to each other, which it seems is a real possibility, Stephen, and I think that's where the fracturing idea comes into play, right? Are they just off in their own virtual space, and there's no interaction, or the fear that some might have, I think it would not be well founded, but the fear that some might have would be that there's an opportunity for those who are within that new species, who are in the virtual worlds, have greater power, they have greater leverage, and that they might exploit or take advantage of the folks they left behind. That seems very unlikely to me, because what actual need would they have of them? It's kind of the conversation we have about the relationship between post-singularity beings and Mosh humans. What do you think, Stephen? This was your question. Where do you think it's going? Is it a problem?
What's that television show, Crossfire? And the answer is,
Stephen gets to answer his own question. Yeah, go.
Okay. Well, my thought is that, the real world geography really does separate people. It had historically. I mean, if you were on the other side of an ocean from another group of people, then there was no interaction often between the New World and the Old World, especially. And the civilizations went their own way completely. The internet and virtual worlds, as we get them, I think may have the opposite effect, in that it would tend to join people together that would otherwise not share any physical space, and be able to interact. And then you leave the virtual world, and you're back in this world, and people will just come and go. I think reality will become an interesting jazz of a mixture of virtual and real. And personally, I can't wait.
All right. Well, a very optimistic scenario from Stephen. I like that. Okay, let's cut to it, folks. We're gonna ask the big question now. Jim alluded to it earlier. I mentioned the simulation hypothesis earlier, and I would like for the panel to weigh in on the simulation hypothesis. But I don't just want to hear your analysis of whether we're living in a simulation or not. Because to me, there's another issue that needs to be addressed here, which is we've talked about our own progression towards creating virtual worlds, our own progression towards creating our own simulations. And so I have a two-part question. One is, are we currently living in a simulation? And then part two is, what does that have to say about whether we ought to be creating further simulations? So... let's start with Natasha on that one.
Oh boy, I hadn't prepared. Okay, this is off the top, so it's not going to be articulate or well thought out. But just off the top, no, we're not living in a simulation. I look at simulations like I look at radical constructivism. And I'm the designer here. You know, you would think that I go, wow, this is cool. I'm just too pragmatic. It doesn't work for me on an emotional level, on an aesthetic level. It doesn't work for me either, and it reeks a little bit too much of God, religion. So I have to bow out on this. I can't go in that direction. And I think the main thing is because I love astronomy. And when I look at the stars and I think about the universe, and I hope to, you know, be able to be on a spacecraft of some sort at some point and to enjoy exploring different habitats, I just can't see that it's a simulation. It's just on my very gut basis of the universe, looking at it and seeing it as something that does exist in the reality I am in, with chemistry and all the messiness of it. To me, it's this is what evolution is, and we just happen to come about.
Okay, so then part two of the question is, let's keep true to this. Then you would be opposed to us ever building simulations where the inhabitants thereof don't know they're in a simulation. Is that right? Because
yes,
that would be...
I think that I just Yeah, that goes against my ethics, my sense of aesthetics as well. I don't like playing with life in that way, and I know we all play with life on some level. You know, when we step on an ant or we hit a wasp, you know, it's. But I can't subscribe to that.
Okay. All right.
I wouldn't mind being in a simulation. I believe in building virtual worlds, certainly, to enjoy. But I as far as creating a life form and putting them in a delusional state intentionally is too hierarchical for me.
Yeah, well, and I think if you go back to the to Bostrom's simulation hypothesis, the second argument is that a post-human civilization would be unlikely to run a significant number of simulations, and maybe it would be out of those kinds of ethical concerns that they would be constrained from doing that, which would argue that we're not currently living in a simulation. Okay, Bruce, same question to you. Are we living in one? And if so, or if not, what does that have to say about whether we should or should not be building simulations of our own?
Yes, I think it's almost certain that we are.
Okay.
But not for any of Bostrom's arguments, but simply because I believe that physics makes the most sense if it's in a simulated environment, in other words, an environment that we're already in. There's simple arguments and then more complex arguments along this line. The simple argument is, going back to Newtonian physics, one billiard ball hits another billiard ball. Seems to make sense, and then we can apply Newton's laws of motion, and we can figure out that ignoring English or any kind of spin, we can figure out where the other billiard ball is going to be going. Makes perfect sense. However, those laws conceal a very deep problem. And the deep problem is, how does the one ball that got hit know that it's being hit from the other ball? Or at a more microscopic level or even a quantum level, how do the atoms or the electron fields interact? How do they know how to influence each other? Now, it makes sense as a simulation. I'm not sure it makes sense as in a pure physics world or the sort of 17th century material world that we've been, I would say brainwashed, but led to believe is the case. A more complex argument, which, you know, is a whole other show, and, you know, we don't have time to go into it, but the idea is that quantum mechanics makes the most sense when treated as a system that attempts to minimize the amount of information that is at play. So, for example, you can reconceive of Heisenberg's uncertainty law, where there's a trade-off in uncertainty between position and momentum, as a conservation of information rather than a conservation of those two quantities. In other words, we're in a simulated environment that's trying to run something without having to use too much memory. So you could extend that argument throughout physics, I believe. I mean, I haven't done it. I don't have the capability of doing it within quantum mechanics, but I believe that can be done. So I think that physics makes the most sense if we are already in a simulated environment. Nothing to do with the brain, nothing to do with our doing simulations. Now, that brings up the second part of the question, is should we, I mean, that's really a normative question, so I can't answer that. But it does bring up an interesting possibility. Rather than creating a digital environment, like a virtual world of the sort that we already created, like Second Life, what I think ultimately is going to happen, I don't know when, but given the first part is true, we are going to be able to begin to manipulate the guts of the universe, so to speak, which in itself is a simulation, in order to change our environment. So in other words, not creating a new simulation, but altering the simulation that we're already in. And I think that point, which, you know, sounds very speculative, I think that point could come when we understand the interaction between consciousness and physics itself, and how consciousness creates environments, and how it does so by interacting with the aforementioned virtual physical universe.
So in the argument from physics that you've given, and I'm not quite sure I follow it, because I'm not sure I understand why a billiard ball has to know anything. It seems like the physical laws are just that one bumps into another. But taking it as a given
it's not just a question of bumping into. There has to be some transfer of information there. The question is not. Of course, it's possible that there's a physical universe. And not only is it possible, most people believe that there's a physical universe. The question is, does it make more sense? Is it more economical? Is it more appealing to think of it as a transfer of information rather than a transfer of physical force? And I think it is, because it makes more sense. It's not just a question of one thing hitting another. It has to give the right sort of information in order for that billiard ball to move in the right sort of way. You know, and that has to happen microscopically among billions and billions of electrons in order for this to work correctly.
I think we're getting confused about what we mean by simulation. When you ask me, are we in a simulation, I'm thinking we're in a computational system simulated like a virtual reality where someone designed it and put us in it, and we're being controlled by that world, like being in the Matrix.
What you're describing imply that someone created the simulation, or could that just be the description of how the physical universe works?
Are you asking me?
Yes, I'm asking you.
Whether it was designed or not, the question is, in what way does the universe make the most sense as a physical system? And I'm saying I believe it's most aesthetically appealing to conceive of it as an informational system rather than as a system that consists of particles. Now, whether somebody designed it or not, or whether it arose spontaneously from nothingness, that's another question.
Very interesting. Well, I have to say, I'm loving the answers I'm getting so far, because both of you have answered now on aesthetic grounds. So I love getting those answers. And it also sounds like, Bruce, you figured out a way we can have a simulation that does not ruin, Natasha, your aesthetic enjoyment of astronomy. So everything could be worked.
Took it off in a totally different direction than I thought we were going in, which is fine. I like that. But information, you can't separate information from particles. Information is matter. I mean, there is no such thing as non-matter. Information has to be something. Everything in the universe does have a field of positive and negative.
We decided that there has to be matter. There only has to be matter if it's a better explanation for what's going on.
Well, no, you're basing it on physical matter. I'm not talking about physical matter. You could say, okay, energy is matter. Energy, I'd rather pass this on to Jim. But I think that we needed to ask this question. I think it's interesting on two points. Number one, that the question was not defined first as far as simulation. And secondly, I like the fact that it wasn't, because it allowed any answer to be valid. But it makes it a little bit confusing at the same point, because when you think of a simulation, you think of someone having created it, like a god or a control person. Someone at the wheel of it who designed it, but your explanation for it did not necessarily have someone who put you in this simulation. You're saying it's a natural process of physics.
Well, although it's not excluded that there might be a designer, I think that's important. Okay, so let's give Jim a chance too before we run out of time. Jim, what do you think? Simulation, yes or no? And if so, what's that say about whether we will, ought to, or how we build simulations?
Sure. So I have to, as a precursor, say that I can't say that I believe anything. And the way I work is I collect evidence and I make, sort of probabilities in my head about what's likely and what's not, and I don't assign numbers to those, but I just, I don't necessarily believe anything at 100%. So I don't think there's one, definitive answer to that question. And I also think it's interesting, I totally get Natasha's pragmatism about this. Nick Bostrom himself, when pressed on the question of, you know, what do you think are the probabilities of being in one of your three scenarios, he started off by saying, you know, 33, 33, 33, you know, one-third, 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 and then he said, but I kind of feel like it's probably a 20% chance. So in other words, even faced with, you know, nothing objective to make a distinction between one of those three possibilities, he still lowered his estimate down to 20% only because of the fact that it seems so outrageous. And so I prefer to go the other way and say, I'm going to look at the probabilities of these things and what are the odds, for example, that we will choose a path such that we don't explore the possibility of creating simulations, post-human simulations. I don't think that'll ever happen. I don't think we will ever make that decision to not pursue some avenue of inquiry that's fascinating to us. We didn't not pursue nuclear energy. We're not pursuing nanotechnology. We're not pursuing slamming particles together in colliders that we don't know what it's going to do. We always pursue those things.
We can't help ourselves, can we?
Right. So I throw that one out entirely, and so you're left with 50-50. And so if you're a pessimist, you believe we will destroy ourselves in the next 30 years, and if you're an optimist, you believe that we're living in a simulation. You know, and then there's that little tiny probability where everybody's clinging to that this is prior to the simulation, and it's that one of the million cases prior to the simulation, and that's just, you know, improbable. So I tend to believe more. I'm not going to say I 100% believe, but I tend to believe more. And I believe for a number of reasons. And it was really great to hear Bruce come up with a couple of different ones because they're ones that I hadn't considered before. The things that I think about are there's the logical argument that Bostrom makes. But, you know, going back to physics, our world, quantum physicists tell us that our world is discrete. That when you get down to 10 to the minus 36 meters, you can't make a distinction between two points, that our reality is locked into a grid of points. Just as a model of a tree or a model of a house is locked into some resolution that we choose. The same with time. They say that the universe clicks on at sequences of 10 to the minus 43rd seconds or jiffies, and that there's, you can't even talk about time in between those chunks of time, and it's like a CPU clocking along at its clock rate. And so you ask yourself the question, you know, why do we have resolutions in simulations that we create and virtual realities that we create? It's a matter of economics. We do it because to create something that has infinite resolution, which is what a continuous system is, costs an infinite amount of money, and it costs infinite amount of disk to store it, an infinite amount of RAM, or whatever the technology is that, you know, may be behind this. It takes infinite resources to create a continuous world, and for that reason, I can't think of any other reason why our world would be discrete. That doesn't say that the resolution of a simulation that we might be living in has to be at the Planck level. Interestingly, I took Moore's law out to where we hit the Planck level in resolution. It's 2192. It's not even that far away. But we're like 20 orders of magnitude away from the Planck level in terms of what we can observe. We can observe, you know, neutrons and subatomic particles that are on the order of 10 to the minus 16th meters. So anywhere in those 20 orders of magnitude could be the real limitation of a system. And then there are, you know, other things, you know, the idea of the finely tuned universe, and I kind of feel like the argument put forth by most cosmologists that there are really zillions of universes in Hilbert space or what other space, and that the anthropic principle tells us that we happen to be only in the one that allows the laws to be as finely tuned as they are, is a lot more outrageous than considering the idea that we're living in a, you know, created programmatic world. So
Jim,
it,
I'm
going really...
to let that be the last word on the subject. We are down to our final seconds here, and all I can say is I had hoped to give everyone a chance to give some parting thoughts, but we've just run out of time. So I want to thank our panel so much. What a fascinating discussion. Enjoyed talking with each of you, and look forward to having you back with us again on a future Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All.
Great conversation.
And I want to also give a quick thanks to our listeners, and a special shout out to everybody who was in the chat room tonight. Thanks for being part of the show.
And, of course, we also want to say thank you to our partner organizations for helping to make this show possible. The Sins Foundation, the Foresight Institute, Humanity Plus, and Singularity University. Also, we want to thank Jean-Sebastien Muse for providing the theme music tonight.
Absolutely. Thanks thanks very much for that. And next week, the World Transformed 2 continues with Part 7, Wealth Transformed. Join us as we welcome Joseph Jackson, Paul Furnout, and Martin Ford. Hope you're able to join us for all of our upcoming programs throughout the World Transformed 2. And until next time, live to see it.